Good morning. Welcome to our roundtable panel. This morning we come to you live from the Linda Norris Auditorium before a live studio audience. Because of the specialness of this morning, we've assembled a dream team of a panel. But first, to prove it's live, let us hear from this great crowd. Many of you at home have done this too, but they gave money to be here. And it's really great to have them. So thank you very much, and welcome to the audience at home. We're delighted to bring you the show from the Linda. It was quite a commute for all of us to walk across the street, but we're here. We have assembled an amazing dream team of panelists this morning. Let me introduce them to you. First, to my left, the one, the only, WAMC's Alan Shartok. University at Albany journalism professor and investigative reporter Rosemary R. Mayo is here. Essayist, author, editor, and activist, and soon to be literary legend as of tomorrow night from the Albany Public Library, along with Gregory Maguire, the one, the only, Barbara Smith. Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain joins us. The Iron Horse. The man we all love to be grumpy with.
Hi,
WAMC's Ray Graff is here.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
By the way, congratulations on winning the Masters.
The seventh hole was the toughest. I had a pitch wedge. It was very difficult.
And last but certainly not least, corporate attorney Rich Honan is here. Perhaps the bravest man to come and to be with us, given his political views. We'll try to change him. We'll see what happens. All right. Well, we want to begin, because we're doing this in front of a live audience, and we have many more panelists than we normally have, and we have, and I'm assuming, if history is correct, that they're going to say a lot. So we thought we'd really limit it to two topics this morning, and we're going to begin by talking about what is happening at the University of Missouri. And one of the things that we have seen over, as this story has unfolded over the past week, is that there has been protests not only at the University of Missouri, but on college campuses throughout the country. And we're seeing this, of course, in our state. We're seeing it in at Smith College, and we're seeing it in campuses throughout the country. So, Alan, what do you make of this? I mean, the initial event, but then the ripple effect of it.
Well, Joe, I think that it's incumbent on the people who are running our universities to figure out that they really have to think, as the first thing to do, is to sit down and talk with people who want to talk to them. So it may be that there are unfounded accusations, that there are rumors, but there is one thing a college president really should learn right from the beginning is you don't pretend they're not there, that people who want to talk to you should be allowed to talk to you. It's not an easy job. It's going to be a harder and harder job.
Rosemary, what do you make of it?
Well, I'm very happy on the one hand to see students taking an interest and a concern in speaking up for themselves. On the other hand, there's a lot coming out now about what exactly is going on in our campuses. Students want a safe place. I'm not so sure colleges should be a safe place. I think they should be willing to confront people who disagree with them, people who don't like them, perhaps. I think the reporting in Missouri has been faulty. For example, one of the supposed attacks on blacks has been a feces, a smeared swastika. How come I haven't seen a picture of it, nor have I heard anybody who actually saw it? And what does the swastika have to do with being anti-black? So I think that there's some things going on that I'm suspicious of, and I don't like that students are thinking that they should shut up people who disagree with them or who even don't like them. So I know that's a little bit off. It's not the usual liberal thing, but I have some concerns about this movement.
Mike?
Well, I think that I agree with Rosemary in that college should be a place where you can disagree and you can express your own opinion and you can learn by hearing the feedback that others give you. If this stifles, classroom discussions and forums from being honest, where people can say how they feel and then maybe get trounced for it on that stage or in that forum and learn something from it, that would be a big loss. It's the tension where you do learn things on college campuses. So if it stifles free speech, this could have a negative effect.
Barbara, we've heard about this culture of racism on this campus, and I'm curious as to what you make of that.
Well, there are a couple of things that I need to say. I don't know how many of you in this room were a black student on a predominantly white campus in the 1960s. Raise your hand. But I was. A little college down the road called Mount Holyoke. So when this occurs, when this kind of thing occurs, and it occurs in cycles, it's not just 2015. I remember in the 1980s having a similar response as what I said to a friend yesterday. I went to college in 65. I graduated in 69. The things that we went through as a tiny fraction, a tiny percentage of that student body at a very competitive college were, in some cases, unspeakable. But the fact that 20 years later, now I'm talking about the 1980s, it was happening at Smith and happening at colleges around and universities around, it is demoralizing. I was really interested in what the person who actually graduated, went to the University of Missouri in 1950. His name is Gus T. Ridgell. He's a PhD in economics. I was really interested in what he had to say, because unlike some who want to try to pretend as if what is happening is not happening, he indeed corroborated how the students were feeling, and he felt very proud of what they were doing as far as law bringing a protest that hit people in their pockets. So this thing about college being a safe place, my profession is teaching literature on the college level. That is my profession. So I have spent time on dozens of college campuses, both as a teacher and also speaking on hundreds of more college campuses all over the country. I think there's a difference between college being a safe place and college being a place where you are subjected to bigotry on a regular daily basis with no recourse. And that does not just apply to students of color. It applies to women. It applies to LGBT students. It applies to students who are Muslim, Middle Eastern, students with disability, Jewish students. And one last thing. Yeah, the swastika has a lot to do with racism. Quiet as it's kept, there were African Americans who were in the concentration camps in Germany.
Rosemary, what did you say?
Yeah, I said, where is the swastika? And the other, some of the other assaults are also called into question. The young man who said a racial slur was thrown at him. Well, he's the same one who went on Twitter and said there's confirmed KKK on campus and then rescinded it because it wasn't true. There's real questions about what's going on. And in some of the other colleges, the assaults are not the same thing that you went through in the 60s. In one campus, there's concern over a Halloween costume where an administrator appeared with two people who had sombreros on. There's nothing inherently racist about that. So it's just this thin-skinned protectiveness that kids have now. They don't want to hear about things that will offend them. They don't want to read about books that have rape or unpleasant crime in it because or God portrayed in a way they don't like. I think that's really dangerous.
We're going to have to agree to disagree.
I thought you might say that.
No, there's something in black feminist theory and black women's studies, my field, that's called standpoint theory. Standpoint theory is when you look at what's the relationship of the individual who is experiencing and recounting their experiences based upon their race, class, racial status, economic status, gender status, sexual orientation, ability, disability, age, etc. You have to look at who's telling you the story, because depending on who's telling you the story, their standpoint, the story changes and differs.
As I mentioned, this is happening on college campuses. There are protests on college campuses throughout the country, including where your Your daughter was one of those laying on the ground yesterday, Rich.
Yes, she was. My daughter Emily is at Ithaca College and took part in the protests, and I had the chance to ask her about both the kind of the triggering events and the protests. And I have to say, I kind of agree with everybody in that if you're not going to show passion about racism on a college campus, then I don't know what you're there for. I think that's an important. That's where it should be shown, and if there's hyperbole, or if you have issues with truth, or if you have issues with what you call standpoint theory, and I think what I call empathy, then those are the places to. That is exactly the place where it should be argued. I will say on the conservative sitting on the far right of the panel, and I think Ray would agree with me. There's some justice and some irony in the fact that these administrators of the college campuses, the place that was the birthplace to us of political correctness, are now, and the place that nurtures political correctness, now these same administrators are being caught in that same web a little bit, and I think we feel like there's a little bit of irony and justification there.
Must be one hell of a dinner table, Rich, at your house.
Yeah. Ray? Well, I was going back to what Barbara said about how these things run in cycles. And I was only 5 years old in 1969. And I know I look really, really old. But, so I want to ask you, Barbara, in now perhaps the beginning of another cycle of these protests, how have things changed? In other words, how is this different than in 1969?
Well, one of the things that's different is that we know what each other are doing very easily. I was, as I said, at Mount Holyoke in the 1960s. We knew when Columbia went out on strike. We knew when Cornell there were sit-ins at Cornell and shutdowns of campuses. We certainly got the information eventually, but today it's instantaneous. But I think we need to look at what's going on in the society and the nation as a whole, not just what's going on these campuses. We are in a period where racial relationships, racial issues, racism, it's all front burner. And it's not only on these campuses. It's the whole cycle. Probably we could start with Trayvon Martin and go from there, because that's when the documentation, particularly through video, of incidents that otherwise would have been dismissed, that's when they began to just proliferate, mushroom. So now we can't say that the guy who was being taken to the hospital because he had done cocaine and had OD'd on cocaine and ended up being tased to death, we can't say that didn't happen. It's on the news 24/7. So the thing is that there's a heightened, I think, sensitivity and awareness around racial issues during this period. But as far as I can see, as I said, my field is teaching literature with a focus on African American studies and women's studies. And as far as I can see, we still are at kind of chapter one as far as understanding how does all this, you know, come together. And I have a book that I'm going to have to dip down and get.
You want one hand?
Yeah.
Oh, we have props on the radio. I love this part.
Here we go.
I mentioned this book last week, and I knew this was going to be a big audience, so I'm mentioning it again. This book is called Waking Up White by Debbie Irving. I recommend it to anybody who wants to try to get a better understanding of, like, what in the world is going on in the United States of America. It's very personal, first person, short chapters, great suggested questions at the end of each short chapter, very, as I said, accessible, an excellent book.
Well, Barbara, what if it turns out that Rosemary is right, that some of the things that have been alleged didn't happen? We all know there's racism in America, but what if the Tinder point, that moment didn't happen? What if there wasn't a feces thing?
We have a similar situation when Rolling Stone reported about a rape on the University of Virginia campus. Everyone thought it was true because there was a culture of rape there and at other campuses. The event itself was untrue. And that's why I'm saying we need to know what really went on, and we do not. And I would contend that what's happening in our campuses detracts from the real things we should be paying attention to, which you've mentioned. Ferguson, Missouri, is right down the road from Columbia, where the school is. Why aren't we paying attention to what's happened there, or to the young man who was tasered to death, or it happened here in our own city, too? I think that there are real problems. Just because I'm doubting what happened at Missouri doesn't mean I'm unsympathetic or that I'm, God forbid, racist. But I don't think that we're getting good reporting on it.
Barbara.
Well, I think, you know, Rosemary, and I love, you know, being on the radio with Rosemary. We are every Friday because she is a journalist. And I like listening to you when I'm not in the studio, too, because you approach things as a journalist. I have a lot of respect for journalism because journalism at the bottom is about getting to the facts. But what I would say about, like, whether each of these singular incidents actually happened, what we see is that there's a problem. So I was actually thinking about the University of Virginia as well, mm-hmm. preparing for this show,
exactly.
because I thought, here's an example of sexual violence that turned out not to be true, but when we uncovered those rocks, those boulders at that right. institution, we saw that there was a huge amount of gender discrimination, sexual violence,
yep.
sexual harassment, you know, the whole continuum. So the thing is, it's not good to lie. No, I'm not saying anybody should ever lie. You know, lies were so bad in my home growing up. It was such a bad word. It was never spoken. We were told not to tell an untruth, because lie was like almost a swear word. So I'm not recommending that people bend the truth or distort what actually happened. But the thing is, these young people's pain around what they experience on a daily basis, that's real. So when the student who's now a senior talks about how her perspective about race changed when she had a white roommate who would sing racist
right.
rap lyrics in her hearing, and then she finds a picture of a lynched black woman on her dorm room door, and when, you know, she reacts to it, you know, well, they actually had a physical fight. She and, you know, they got into a physical fight because the roommate said, oh, my friends put that up. It was just a joke. Really? Does anybody know how many thousands of people were lynched in this country?
Well, we're going to take a break, and you always want to know what happens during the break, so now you're about to find out. And those of you at home, pledge next time. We'll be back from Linda on the roundtable panel.
Support for WAMC comes from Bedard Brothers Cheshire, featuring 7 brands in 1 location, Chevrolet, Honda, Volvo, Chrysler, Jeep, Dodge, and Ram, plus late model pre-owned cars and trucks. It's hard to beat Bedard. Online, bedardbrothers.com. Amherst Copy and Design Works, offering printing and copying, sign making and design services, from booklets to stationery and labels to lawn signs in downtown Amherst, Massachusetts, amherstcopy.com. And Northshire Bookstore, hosting Simon Van Boy for his book, Tales of Accidental Genius, Tuesday, November 17th in Manchester, Vermont. Northshire.com.
Sorry about that.
That was very unsatisfactory break.
Yeah, no, okay. Good morning. I am now, so for those of you listening at home, I'm now wading deep in the audience here to get comments from people normally you would write in. Today we're going to get comments, and here we go. We'll begin here.
Don from Schenectady. So I think that whenever we talk about racism in the States and the cycle, nowadays that I can't really separate that from what I think has been a very racist approach to President Obama. And while members of Congress aren't overt on it, certainly if you look below the surface, I can't believe that the way that Congress has responded, and I'm talking primarily about the Republican members of Congress, that it doesn't reflect a level of racism. And if there's racism towards the president, it is not surprising that you would find racism on the campus.
I think there's racism in all parts of our society. I welcome the discussion. I'm really glad college students are out talking about this and expressing themselves. What I worry about is that they are suppressing other speech. There was even, I guess we're going to get to it later, an attempt to keep the media away from their own protests. They invite the media in, you know, show people what we're talking about, and then there was an attempt to keep them away from an area of Missouri. I taught at the University of Missouri, so I know where it is. It's a completely public space on a public university, and they didn't want the media there. So there's an effort to get out a message as they want it, exactly how they want it, and that I can't stand up for.
Rosemary, would you remind everybody of the exact story of what happened?
Well, Joe, do you want to do this? You have the background.
Well, we can go. Let's get another comment, and then we can go back. Okay, hold on.
My name is Jay, and I'm from Del Mar. And Barbara, thank you so much for bringing up standpoint philosophy, because I think it really speaks to something that I've heard Rosemary say a couple of times about students being resistant to reading stories that include rape or sexual assault. And it really is important to honor the trauma that people have experienced who have suffered sexual assault, mm-hmm. to force them to relive that trauma through reading things in a classroom is really sort of barbaric. And so I just wanted to put that out there as a perspective to consider.
No, I think that's legitimate. Any individual student can go up and say, I can't read this, and that would be respected. But what's happening is that certain books and articles are being banned, or teachers are having to give a warning. It's just like we can't eat peanuts on a plane anymore because certain people are allergic.
Is there anything inherently wrong with giving a warning, though, if you're not banning the book?
Well, do you know what can trigger anybody trauma in anybody in every book that you're assigned? No, I think there's.
But you're not banning the book. You're just saying, hey, watch out. If your personal
experience.
No, the
movement is to ban certain books and reading material and viewing material from classes.
And Ray, by that standard, there should be a warning to anybody who enters a university. That warning, there's going to be learning about
warning
about
ideas
issues
are here.
I
see what you're saying. Yeah,
right? that may or may not.
Yes, you have to sign a disclaimer.
You know, the great thing about doing the show in front of a live audience is that we actually hear people clap and boo at us in real time. That's great.
Yes.
I have one other problem with standpoint, with that theory, which is that if that's true, the only person who can really speak about it is Barbara and the woman who asked the question back there, and that shuts the rest of us out. And just as whites have shut blacks out of the discussion for many years, it can't work the other way. We have to be talking to each other.
I always accuse Rosemary of throwing a bomb right before we go to a break. Because right now I'm looking at Barbara vigorously shaking her head. I have someone here who wants to say something, but go ahead, Barbara.
Well, no, that's not what standpoint theory really asserts. What standpoint theory says is that it is legitimate to look at someone's actual material circumstances and status in a society to figure out what they might indeed be experiencing that you're experiencing at the very same time, very differently. So that's really what it's about. And the thing is, there's always room for dialogue. That's the only way we're ever going to get anywhere. Around this is dialogue, and I've devoted my life to dialogue around these very, very fraught and difficult topics. A lot of people run screaming away, and I'm like, you know, the first responder running in around issues of race. And,
we can agree on that.
Yeah, and other oppressions. So it's not like I don't think dialogue is important, but the thing is that there's this subtle kind of like, okay, I'm not you. I'm going to take into account how you feel. Debbie Irving does a good job of explaining that in this book, too.
All right. 30 seconds.
Hi, I'm Allison from Voorheesville. I just wanted to say that I agree with Rosemary that kids shouldn't be, there shouldn't be banning of books or even a warning, because people are coddling kids these days, and that doesn't help. It's, I think, related to the helicopter and just taking too much care with kids.
So it's the early 1960s. I'm in high school taking honors English, and the book that's assigned is a book you may have heard of called The Great Gatsby. And so we're reading The Great Gatsby, and I actually went to an integrated school, even though I was going to school during the Ice Age. And the thing is that, and that's very unusual for a black person of my age.
Just only about 20 seconds, but go ahead.
But in any event, we were very upset by the racism in the book. We talked to our teacher about it. There's nothing he could do about it. The book was written, but it had an effect. Whether we needed a warning, I don't know, but it had an effect.
We are live at the Linda in downtown Albany on Central Avenue, the WAMC panel. We have a live audience, and we will continue our conversation. Our whole group is here. I'll reintroduce them when we come back, but first, we will go to news from the BBC. Good morning, and welcome back to our panel. We are live at the Linda in downtown Albany, and we have our panelists' dream team. We're before an audience of about 150 people. They sound great. How great do they sound here? Listen to this. Rich Honan, Mike Spain, Rosemary Armeo, Alan Shartok, Barbara Smith, Ray Graff are all here. I'm your host, Joe Donahue, and we'll get to some more topics. We took a poll during the, you know, they're very accurate. We took a poll during the break asking people if we want to continue with this conversation or move on to the election, and moving on to the election won.
Okay.
So we are going to, we're going to talk about that. And let's begin with, oh, well, did Hillary Clinton want to be a Marine?
Did Hillary Clinton want
I think
what?
She was recruited and offered a scholarship to the
yes,
Marine
Corps. Yes, she, so now... Very nice. So
we,
or maybe not.
We've been hearing all week, of course, about Ben Carson and making up this story, allegedly, about West Point. So now, after a week of debate... of whether Ben Carson really won a scholarship to West Point, Republicans have refocused the question of military service on Hillary Rodham Clinton, expressing doubts about her claim that she tried to join the Marines in the 1970s. The matter came up after an event in New Hampshire this week when Mrs. Clinton, the frontrunner for the Democratic presidential nomination, shared a story with voters about her interest as a young woman in becoming a Marine. The story of her aspirations has come up before as questions about her honesty on the subject.
Okay, well, when I was 13, I wanted to be a nun.
Is that true, Mom?
To the delight of your mother, I'm sure.
I did. I had a rosary on the side of my bed, and I read the Bible, and I wanted to be a nun, and I considered it. And I believe that's what Hillary's talking about. I listened to her speech that set this whole thing off. And what she talks about is that she went and talked to somebody about it to see if it was a fit for her. And quickly, it wasn't just like I discovered boys. She discovered there's kind of rules rules in the military, and it wouldn't work for her. So I think that what we're seeing is a Republican reaction to and retaliation to what happened to Ben Carson, which was that his story is being vetted line by line, as is appropriate for the front runner for the nomination for the Republican Party. And I think Hillary has to deal with it, too. I don't mind that they've gone after her, but I think there are real lies that they might talk about to more benefit, like that whopper that she told about. I went to Bosnia and she was in Tuzla and bullets flew at her. And there was never any fighting in Tuzla. I've been there. It never happened. So what about that? And what really did happen the night of Benghazi? I mean, she did a great job in front of the panel, but I still wonder, why did she tell her family it's a terrorist act while she was telling the rest of us it was not, that it was a reaction to a movie? So there, if you want to talk about Hillary lying, let's go after the big ones and forget this stuff. We know Hillary, and I don't think we have to go over her story line by line. That's different with Ben Carson, who is new on the national stage.
But are you offended by Ben Carson and West Point? I mean, I thoroughly understand what happened. The guy, somebody comes up to Ben Carson and says, look, you're a brilliant student, you're at the top of your class, I can get you into West Point if you want an appointment. And he says, he doesn't do a thing about it. I mean, let's face it, I'm not a big Ben Carson fan. But I think that this has been over the top.
That would be fine if that were the only thing they're talking about. There's new stories coming out every day, including one today about his connections to a businessman who committed fraud, healthcare fraud.
Right.
So what's a doctor doing with that?
But wait, I'm still going to pursue this with you about the West Point thing. I think if you get a new one and it turns out to be viable and important, then you do it.
His
but
book is exaggerated.
It's
puffed up, Alan. Come on. He's explained it away, but that's
I think
not
we
what
have to.
I
think we have to step back and say, wait a second. Could somebody have said to me, I could get you into Yale, and then 50 years later, you say I could have gone to Yale, because of this? Is this really big stuff?
Well, the issue is
the beginning.
It's not.
It's the first thing they've dug up. Just stay tuned. This is how journalism works.
And on
works.
Hillary's side,
Mike Spain.
Well, no, I just was going to say there's a lot of other things that Ben Carson has said that merit scrutiny. I agree with Alan. You can just use a little hyperbole to understand that that was an option he did not pursue, but somebody threw out at him 50 years ago. But the whole notion that he attacked his mother with a hammer, that he stabbed this guy.
That's different.
You know, that he...
Yes.
Very, you know...
Or that China has an interest in Iraq or Afghanistan.
Right.
China?
Right. China being involved in Syria.
Syria.
He is asserting that Vladimir Putin made connections to Mahmoud Abbas from Palestine while they were in Moscow back in the 60s attending Patrice Lumumba University. And it turns out that at the time, Putin was 18 years old and he was in St. Petersburg. I mean, you know, there's a lot of real factual discrepancies you can hang on Ben Carson. You don't need to get bogged down in this nuance about whether he was offered, quote unquote, the scholarship to West Point. I think that's immaterial. And all the people who are going after Hillary on this are doing is looking foolish, I think. There's plenty. I agree, Rosemary. There's plenty of things in Hillary's past that have been scrutinized and she should be held accountable for. And this just is small potatoes.
But Rich, yeah, and I think, I'll let you into some of the thinking on our right wing conference calls.
Talking points.
Yes. You and the conspirators.
Yes. Yes. You and Mr. Burns.
Right. I will tell you, as frustrated as you are when you hear the Republicans talking about was Hillary going to be a Marine. We on the conservative side are more frustrated because it's just another example of, in this case, the Republicans dealing with irrelevancies, dealing with things that have nothing to do with the core issues that we really want to talk about, which we will probably disagree on, but we want to talk about. And it really just serves to undercut our credibility in trying to have a conversation on the important issues.
Alan, you were going to say?
No.
Okay. Ray, do you have anything you want to add?
No, I think Rich hit it out of the park.
Oh. Well, this is no fun. You guys
it's
used to fight.
This is not fun at all.
Okay, so now for Bernie Sanders, the headline in... How many Bernie fans do we have here?
Oh, boy.
Well, that's shocking.
Communist. Not that many, but they're very loud.
You know communist.
All right, so Iowa may now be everything for Bernie Sanders, says the Washington Post. Volunteers going door to door. There may be no important event on the calendar for Sanders than Iowa's first in the nation caucuses. He's counting on a political revolution to sweep him into the White House, but with Hillary Clinton regaining strength over the past month in the fight for the Democratic nomination, there's a growing sense that Iowa could instead be the beginning of the end if Sanders doesn't pull off back-to-back victories in Iowa and New Hampshire.
You know, I get asked all the time, is Bernie in it to move the conversation to the left, or does he really think he can be president? I've interviewed Bernie Sanders maybe 100 times over the years. And I can tell you right now, he wanted to move the conversation, but he also wanted to be president. And you can just look at this guy. He runs for city council. He gets defeated. He runs again. He runs for mayor. He wins. Then he runs for congressman, and he wins. Then he runs Jewish Bernie Sanders with a Brooklyn accent in Vermont, runs for United States Senator from Vermont, of all places, and he wins. Now, how do you tell him he can't be president?
He can't be president.
He can't be president.
All right. I didn't say, Rosemary, that he could be president. I said, how do you tell him? I mean, to be perfectly honest with you,
the vote in Iowa is going to be a hint to him.
But
well, that's the analysis.
But you've got George Pataki up there in New Hampshire.
He can't be president either.
And if you put a lie detector on his arm. And you said to him, who had been governor of New York, unbelievably, for three terms, can you be president? And he'd say, of course, you'd get a straight line from the lie detector. He believes it. Mm-hmm.
So meanwhile, on the Republican side, the campaign hit a new level with the attacks between Ted Cruz and Senator Marco Rubio yesterday. They're fighting over the immigration record. Immigration, of course, was topic that was the first topic, but also I would think the strongest topic that was discussed during Tuesday's debate. And with many thinking that, still thinking that Ben Carson and Donald Trump, who are the two front runners, may flame out, that leaves Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio, who are now battling it out in their own. Rich, do you want first
These
on that?
These are your guys.
When you think about it, they're both arguing. Both of them are you know, members of a Senate that's been unable to do anything on immigration, and they're arguing about what things they were unable to do. I don't see it as a terribly relevant conversation.
But don't you think, Rich, that that Rubio comes out better in this particular fight?
Yes. I think Rubio, and I would say this in any room, not just this room, I think Rubio is always going to come out better,
Cruz.
To moderates than Ted Cruz. Yeah, yeah, absolutely. I think that Ted Cruz comes across as, at least to you folks and maybe to some others, as right-wing to the point of scary. And Rubio comes across as, you know, a little
cute.
More open.
He's right-wing and scary, but he's exactly. cute.
Wow. No, he's more reasonable. Wow.
Right.
I was going to say rational. You said cute.
Yeah, but we all know.
I'm not sure about rational.
But we all know from all of the studies that that the way you appear on television, look, everybody had a political science class in which you heard the difference between how Nixon and Kennedy came out, one on the radio and one
Absolutely.
On the television. It means a lot.
Absolutely.
Right. I agree. That's, so all the people are sitting there typing right now about Rosemary always brings up physical aspects, way, way important in journalism and in politics. Mm.
All right. I want to, we're going to take a break, and then we'll go out into the crowd and we'll get some comments. I'm just feeling that people have a lot to say on this issue,
yeah.
which we're just going to broaden out to the presidential race 2016, and we can talk about that in our last break. We are here live at the Linda on this Friday the 13th, and so far, nothing's gone wrong. We'll be right back after this short break.
Support for WAMC comes from Atelier Rene Fine Framing Red Hook, a resource for custom framing gifts for the holidays, photos, art, needlework, diplomas, mirrors, gift cards, and more. AtelierReneFineFraming.com. And Hilltown Artisans Guild, Worthington, Massachusetts. Juried show of art and handmade items this Saturday and Sunday from 10 to 4. Town Hall, Worthington, Massachusetts. HilltownArts.com.
On the radio every morning. And there's the man with the scalpel.
Oh,
all right, everybody who wants to say something, raise their hand, please. Okay, great. All right. And then, you know, we can add on here, obviously.
All right.
Hey, welcome back. Are we back? Yes, we're back. Good morning. Thank you very much for being here in our panel discussion. I'm now in the audience. It's, you know, there used to be a guy who held a microphone and used to run through the audience and take people's comments, and his name was Phil Donahue.
Oh, yeah.
And now I get to do it. So who has the first? Yes, here, I'm up here. There you go. Sir.
I'm Fred from Freehold. I'd like to know, I'm pointing to our conservative member, as a registered,
do you feel labeled?
As a registered Republican, and I'm following Bernie Sanders on Facebook, and there are Republicans for Bernie Sanders, and I happen to be one of them. But having to look forward to the primary, I am at a crossroads of who to vote for, because the GOP, I haven't seen anybody that particularly I would vote for in the primary, much less in the general election, and I've never cared for Billary, and I will never vote for her. I haven't voted, didn't vote for him, didn't vote for her when she was running for Senate, and I won't vote for her if she does become the nominee. So who would you vote for in the primary for GOP?
Oh boy. Oh
who would
boy.
You choose?
I won't say who I would vote for, but I will say I've spoken to a lot of a lot of people who are in the same dilemma as you. Most of us on the Republican side are in the same dilemma, and for a lot of folks like you, the answer is John Kasich. Right? That's the closest you're going to come, except that now you have this issue of I'm going to vote for a guy who's not going to make it past the nomination, which is your same issue with Bernie. So my answer to you is Kasich, and then take it from there.
Discuss, enjoy. Yes, ma'am.
Hi, Cindy from Queensbury. Rosemary, I kind of take that point. When I watched Rachel Maddow spend 5 minutes on Hillary's hair, and she couldn't find a picture of Hillary Clinton, no matter what your perspective is on Hillary Clinton, she couldn't find a picture of her without Bill right next to her. I would go to staff meetings, and that's how they would sort of throw me out to the other people. Like, you guys, you don't have to listen to her because she's just a girl. And the first thing they would say is, did you change your hair color?
Yep.
This is in a staff meeting where I'm supposed to be doing it.
The whole Billary thing. Yeah, really.
I was like, these aren't campaigns. These are assassinations. I mean, it's just awful. I've never seen it. Okay, no political campaign is clean or sweet or natural. Okay. But this time out, between the Republicans and the Democrats, honest, it's no different than Putin shooting lions and riding horses.
It's a lot different because Putin already has the fix in.
Fixed in, right. Yeah. So, I mean, but my point is the fix is in here, too, as far as I'm concerned.
Really? Who wins?
Because nobody.
Nobody wins?
Nobody wins. My point is now you have dynasties appearing. Dynasties appearing. And because of the way I think primaries should be unconstitutional. You get out there and you vote. Okay, you shouldn't have to be held to a party. In fact, I don't see anything in the Constitution that says there are political parties, Republican and Democrat or whatever. And so what happens is you now can't have any kind of clean political party.
I don't know that I have to respond. I think that was a statement. It was pretty interesting. Yeah, I'd like to vote directly, too. Get rid of the Electoral College.
And by the way, we do have dynasties or, as they say in England, dynasties, for right here in New York State, in case you hadn't heard. And it's interesting to watch somebody running on a name and then the second election getting more than a million fewer votes than you got the first time. So dynasty only lasts so long, and then your record starts counting for a lot.
Is the Bush dynasty done?
What'd you say?
Is the Bush dynasty done?
It would appear. It would appear.
Jeff's son is an amazing kid.
Well, here's the deal.
Yeah.
Here's the deal. The question is the fix in? The Republicans are not going to allow either Trump, in my opinion, or Carson to run for president of the United States because they'll lose, and they want to win. So that's why he's done. He has performed very badly. But when they come into the election and you got all these guys who are there honorifically and the Democrats have the same thing, and they say, we're going to lose if we have this. This morning there's a resurgence in the paper about getting Mitt Romney to run again to save them.
Can we take up this issue of dynasties? Is it real? Isn't that kind of a bad metaphor? In this country, we're proud when our children go into the family business. And we accept it for our dry cleaner, our butcher, celebrities. Huh. Why is it so unusual that the Bush children, the Clinton children, whatever, are going into what's a family
public
business?
Public service.
Public service, yeah. Right.
All right, we can't. Hold on. I'm all the way over here, and you don't have a mic in front of you. So let me.
But I think you were on the right track.
Yes, we'll get to you in a second. Hold on. This is what happens when you talk to your radio. We don't hear you either.
Hi, my name is Patrick. I'm from Albany. And I came to this country in 1964 as an immigrant from Ireland, and I became a citizen in 1971. So I followed politics pretty closely over the years, and I voted consistently. And I don't think I've ever seen anything in an election cycle like this where people, in their personal CVs, and I think it's quite legitimate that things that people have done in their past. We all have CVs. These are CVs for an election. That's what they are. Mm-hmm. And why the need to distort facts? And it happens on the Republican side, and it happens on the Democrat side. And so I'd like the panel to kind of address that issue. Why is there a need in this that these people have to do that? Why can't they just say out front what is really correct instead of making misstatements.
Well, the thing is that these people believe their stuff. That's what you have to understand. It's not that they're purposely lying. When a guy like Carson says to you, I was offered an appointment to West Point, he believes he was offered an appointment to West Point. That particular thing was not a lie, in my opinion. But there are, of course, people who lie.
May I ask, what do you say? Are you saying CDs?
CVs. CV.
Your resumes.
As in career, yeah.
In your resume.
Oh, yeah, I have one.
are you running?
Yeah. But most people don't have CVs. They have resumes. So that's why I couldn't.
Okay, go ahead.
Nathan from Boston, Massachusetts. To the point of the hair issue, to the point of staying on point, to the point of the minutiae that we analyze in the media today. What is the responsibility of journalists to stay on point, and what is the responsibility of journalists to keep the points relevant in this 24-hour news cycle with constant coverage on multiple satellite and cable channels?
Okay.
Boy, you just handed Rosemary that one.
Well, yeah, that was
Look
me.
At the time.
I'm interested in Rosemary's opinion, but because of his legacy and what he's brought to the world, I'm really interested in Alan's opinion.
Okay. You want to go first?
Oh. Well,
he wants you.
And implicit in your voice is, why would he want that?
Don't talk to me about
voice. All right,
voice.
You know what?
All right.
No, I just want to point one thing out, and that is, in these debates, Trump comes in, and you get ratings that you never expected before in anything like this. That's what counts to NBC. That's what counts as when Saturday Night Live puts Trump on the television, and they have the largest single watchership of, I think, all times. When it's that. So it's all about the money. Come on. It isn't. I mean, I love you guys, and you're all intellectuals, and you sit there and let's discuss the issues. But they don't care about the issues. They care about the guilt.
All right, Rosemary.
This question, and our questioner here did it too, is always posed as, you know, what should the media cover, this or this, and where keeping focus? I don't think that's our job. I think we should cover everything. The CVs that have been puffed up, the issues, how they perform in the debate. I think all of that is relevant to helping us make a decision about how we're going to vote. The job of the media is to inform the electorate so that they can make decisions that support democracy.
How's the media doing this time around, Rosemary?
Yeah. How is the media doing now?
Yeah.
They're having a really bad time because of Trump. Yeah. And to a lesser extent, Carson, because they were seen as, oh, this is just a joke. They'll flame out. And they haven't. And that means many people, many Republicans at least, are taking them seriously. So do we continue to laugh about it? No. We cover them seriously. And yes, we are getting rewarded
but
for
no,
it.
But no, you don't. If you're saying we cover everything, and I'm not convinced that is the media's job to cover everything, especially in this day and age when everything is everything. Right? I mean, I think it's more the media's job at some level to try and determine what are important issues and then cover
no.
those.
Oh, God, no. Then you have Roger Ailes of Fox. He's making that decision, the president of NBC.
But
remember,
that's,
talking
that's,
about exaggerating. How about Brian Williams? He should be deciding what we're going to cover in the past.
Look,
no.
But look, 20 years ago, when you would read a newspaper, and at the top three or four stories would be the same in every newspaper. They
Correct.
Would they wouldn't be they
Those
wouldn't
were the
be
bad old
covered
days.
The same way. And these days are better?
Yes, these days are better. Now
I,
you can
I,
find
I
if we have people who are willing to look and to read, to go online, to research, as many people here are. Many more Americans are not. You are getting fantastic coverage.
We have about 90 seconds. Mike.
Well, I was just going to say, we have access to much more information now. We have, the internet has just opened up so much. Rosemary's right. And all of these things need to be covered. But what happens is certain stories get traction and they need to be vetted. And that's really what's going on now. And the other thing I was just going to add is that the politicians are doing what they've done in the past. They're attacking the media. Not everybody does as good a job as others in the media, and there is criticism that's valid, but it was what? Spiro Agnew, who famously went after journalists and turned the... And look what happened to him. I mean, you know, he was a crook.
Not
he went
Nabob.
To prison. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's really, you know, it's easy to attack the media, but you know, they're just doing their job. They're not trying to run for any office.
All right, we have one minute. What? Final statements?
I thought you had something you wanted to respond to.
A Republican candidate.
Yes.
Oh.
Final statement?
About the election?
Yes.
Oh, goodness, no.
I'm with you.
I can't go there.
Alan?
Well, I just love the fact that we have this wonderful audience and that we have all of you out there.
All right, Rosemary, roll her eyes.
My final statement is we have to stop the TSA immediately.
And now to hour number two.
Yes. Mike Spain.
I can't add anything more than that.
Rich Honan?
I just thank you for listening politely to dissenting viewpoints. I appreciate it.
A big hand for our entire panel. Rich Honan, Mike Spain, Rosemary Romeo, Alan Shartok, Barbara Smith, Ray Graff. I'm Joe Donahue. We love each and every one of you for being here, for pledging, for being our... For being our lifeline. Thank you so much for coming. Hey, guess what? We have another 2 hours of the show, but we're not going to do it here with you. So drive carefully. Thank you very much for coming. Bye. Be well.